Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to this week's Your Own Personal Beatles, featuring me, Robin Allender.
And I am Jack Pelling.
Thank you for joining us, and this week we're delighted to welcome Shappi Korsandi to talk about her own personal Beatles, and it was a great chat with Shappi, I thought.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I really enjoyed listening back to it. It was one of those, another one where we could have gone on for hours and hours, but yeah, she was absolutely brilliant.
She was on sparkling form after a single glass of wine. It was really good.
it was fantastic. Yep, she had her delightful son buttling for her. Which was lovely. And yeah, we chatted a lot about sort of her youth. She talks really brilliantly about sort of being young and stuff, partly because she's got a fantastic book about it, I'm sure. But some amazing memories of her sort of early Beatles relationship. And we went really around the houses, discussed a lot of, bit of magical mystery tour, a little bit of, you know, what it's like listening to the Beatles from, you know, someone who's moved to the West at an early age, and the sort of cultural significance that takes on, and their part in sort of cultural identity as well, which is interesting, especially at the moment where post-Euros people are sort of wondering what it is to be proud to be English and stuff, and the part that the Beatles play in that, which is a fascinating chat.
Shappi's book, A Beginner's Guide to Acting English, is really fantastic, and she, as you say, she writes so well about being a child and those kind of impressions and the way you kind of experience life as a child. And I think in the podcast she talks about that really well in terms of the experiencing of music. And I think some of her stories, particularly about Fool on the Hill, are just brilliant. You know, what an incredible kind of connection she has to that song.
And as she's a fantastic comedian, so obviously it's incredibly funny as well. So yeah, get stuck in. If you want to hear an extended version of this podcast episode, you can join our Patreon by going to patreon.com/personalbeatles, and you can get an extra sort of about 20 minutes extra out of this one, which is really worth doing. So thank you for everyone who has joined that. We really appreciate the support. You also get some bonus episodes coming up. We should have the first one of them next week, which is exciting. And then a few old faces from series one turning up to join us for a couple of extra ones over the next couple of months. So lots to be looking forward to.
Yeah. I've got a couple of little things to read out. The first one is Joe from Beatles Books, who is a brilliant online presence and one of the nicest Beatle chaps I've definitely met since doing the podcast. Nice. He posted online a brilliant uncut interview with Paul McCartney, where I think it was from around the time Revolution in the Head came out.
Okay.
And we obviously talk
early
a lot
90s.
About 94, 95, I think. And he obviously talks a lot. We obviously talk a lot about Revolution in the Head, but this is Paul McCartney's take on it. Well, it might be compelling reading for you. I'm not going to do the Scouse accent like the guy who does the audiobook.
Yeah, we're both listening to the audiobook of Mark Lewisohn's Tune In at the moment, where he slips into a very broad Scouse accent for every quotation, no matter how long or how obvious it is. So
even if it's just a single word.
He tends to say, and that morning John went down the shops.
This is Paul. Well, it might be compelling reading for you, but not for me it isn't, because I keep finding all the mistakes in it. McCartney did this because of that. And I'm sitting there thinking, no, he didn't. Or John Lennon was out of his head on this when he wrote that. No, he wasn't. I should know because I was fucking there. It's all this received wisdom shit. It's good that someone like Ian bothered to write a book about us. I'm sure a lot of it is very perceptive. But what do you do when you're me? When someone is telling you what it's like to be in a room writing a day in the life and you're thinking, no, that's not what it was like at all. It can be very enraging, that sort of thing. That's great, but because I often find myself thinking about Paul McCartney, thinking, what do you do when you're me?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, that's great.
That's
I love
crazy.
That quote.
Yeah, there was another video of Ringo saying pretty much the same thing that was posted on Twitter this week, of him just being like, yeah, 70% of it's absolute bollocks. I never read any of it. You know.
But I kind of, I mean, Revolution Then Head gets a lot of stick for how opinionated it is.
Yeah.
But I kind, that's kind of why I like it, to be honest with you. And yeah. even when I read it in impressionable age, like, I loved Helter Skelter. It didn't matter that he didn't like it. You know what I mean?
But it does have that thing, yeah, I don't like it when it sort of begins to change my opinion because he presents his opinions as objective fact.
Yeah, like he just...
And then once you hear that, you're like, oh yeah, actually, all the George Harrison ones up until like 1966 are terrible.
Well, but he's... Yeah.
He doesn't like very... George's... He doesn't really like any of George's songs.
He does, and I think.
Well, I don't think... the early ones, he sort of gets... Yeah. He's a bit more complimentary as it goes through. And then he obviously has his favourite period is the Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, Sgt. Pepper is the kind of pinnacle, yeah.
And Day it's in the Life, I think he describes as like the greatest. Like, that's the apex moment.
I think I Am the Walrus might be his personal fave.
Really,
but he's also quite... He is fond of Don't Bother Me, the Harrison song. I think he said, it sort of says it's a little bit overlooked.
Oh, really? It's one of my least favourites.
Yeah, I like it. And I was thinking, is that the first...
I hate it.
But I was thinking, is that the first Beatles song that kind of isn't about love and shagging?
Yes, it's about being moody.
It's about being moody,
having a cold.
Yeah, you wrote it on.
The other I don't like it at all. It's very...
The other thing I wanted to talk about briefly was there's a brilliant book which came out earlier this year by music journalist Harry Sword, which is called Monolithic Undertow in Search of Sonic Oblivion. And it's absolutely brilliant and incredibly well-researched book about drone music and about drone culturally, I suppose. Just a little bit from the introduction. The drone requires neither cord nor band, representing by its infinite pliability and accessibility the ultimate folk music, a potent audio tool of personal liberation. And so it's really good, and it gets into some really interesting, like, and heavy and obscure acts, you know, from Velvet Underground to the kind of, you know, Stooges, Sonic Youth, Swans, Black Sabbath, Sleep, Melvins, Eno, and then the, like, more avant-garde, Eliane Radic, who I absolutely love. But of course, like, the Beatles are in it. And I think that's what I kind of, why we're doing this podcast, because no matter how far out the music is, you can still bring it back to the Beatles. And, you know, this is just a really good bit about Tomorrow Never Knows here. Touching on Indian classicism, musique concrète, and the joy of staunch noise, Tomorrow Never Knows was the drone in action, transcendent magic captured on tape. Neither some blissed-out peace-and-love trip nor the black acid nightmare later evoked by Hawkwind at their most incandescent. The song was rather a call to submission. The seismic cranial shift the Beatles underwent on Revolver from the lightweight pop of Please Please Me just 3 years earlier was truly remarkable, a testament to both tireless studio experimentation and the cranial power of the successful and repeated acid test. So I thought it was just great to...
Yeah, that's great.
I mean, to read about kind of all these obscure acts and very experimental acts, and to also see Beatles as being a part of that history, I think is like, it's kind of why we're doing this, I think.
You know? Yeah, yeah, sure.
Because it's like there's always new ways to talk about them.
Yeah, and that's brilliantly put, and it's such a great example of how you can use sort of a one chord song in that track as well, because it is sort of drones that, you know, you think big open fifths that are sort of harmonically ambiguous, but Tomorrow Never Knows is just C major all the way through. You know, it uses that sort of alternating major third is the key to the melody. So it's, but that, yet there's so much variation. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Really interesting. I like that. I'm going to read that book. It's on my list.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Lovely stuff. Right, well, so let's crack on with Shappy Call Sandy. We'll be back at the end of the show. But yeah, please, if you want to get in touch with us, you can send in some of your personal Beatles stories to jack@homespunsounds.com, and keep in touch with us on the old social medias as well, @personalbeatles on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all that lovely stuff.
Yes. And also watch this space for our first bonus podcast, which should be coming out.
Yeah, we're going to record it next week. So a little bit of delay due to me contracting the old Rona. But we'll have it for you next week. So yeah, check out the Patreon and enjoy the show.
Oh, cheers, guys.
Cheers.
This is lovely.
Cheers. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Yeah. I'm just sorry I can't offer you anything to eat.
No, no. I mean, okay. Yes, so we're delighted to welcome Shappi Korsandi to Your Own Personal Beatles, and she's drinking a glass of red wine brought to her by her son.
There we are. That's parenting.
So cheers.
Good parenting.
Yeah.
So how are you? How has things been? How's the slightly strange life for a comic over the last year?
It's been weird. And also, I can I just be really thick and ask you, are we recording now?
Yes, we've started recording. Yeah. That's why I did that slightly stilted intro there.
I loved your intro. I thought it was very good. I thought you were very smooth-voiced.
Thank you.
And I thought you were very confident.
Yeah, we're trying to sort of adopt that sort of Adam Buxton thing of just, luging into the conversation.
Yeah, well, Jack sometimes does a very good kind of Radio 4 sort of intonation.
I spend my life trying to be Adam Buxton. Yeah. Whenever I go walking my dog, I just call her Rosie sometimes just to feel a little bit more Adam. and I remark to myself about the weather and the grey dome of the sky but there's no one to hear it but me. Can I please, well, I'm going to tell you how much I love the title of your podcast. And because I when there's a band when you're a teen usually that becomes the band that makes you realize that music is life. And for me, that was Depeche Mode when I was 15.
Nice.
Oh, well, there you go.
And so I was very excited, Your Own Personal Beatles.
Yeah.
Because it's, two big loves of mine. I'm enjoying this wine. Yeah. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a weak pun, but I feel that it's a good enough title.
Well, it's because, obviously John said they were, the Beatles were bigger than Jesus. So it's kind of multi-layered.
Exactly. Oh, yes. Oh, there we go. I like that. You see, you're clever podcasters.
Diving straight into the Beatles, what was your compared to most people we've had on the podcast, your sort of early years were probably a bit more irregular. So where did the Beatles first pop up and what was your sort of early life like for people who might not know?
Well, I don't have any musical pedigree from my parents, unless it's, classical Iranian music or Iranian pop music in a restaurant at 2 a.m. when the grown-ups are dancing and us kids are sort of curled up under the table trying to sleep, which was a lot of my life as a child. I remember once the owner of a restaurant set up a camp bed in the kitchen for me to sleep on because everyone wanted to carry on dancing and boozing. So we had a record player and we just had the soundtrack to Yentl, the soundtrack to Cinderella, an Elton John album and a Shirley Bassey album.
Nice.
And there was no money to buy music in my family back then. And my generation is a generation where if you wanted to listen to music, you went to a friend's house because you heard they had a certain album. So I know, Yentl off by heart, the Cinderella soundtrack off by heart, and Banger. Elton John. Yeah, and I know, ask me anything about Shirley Bassey, I know it all. So that was my early music. And
This was in Iran.
Oh, no, this is here.
So you moved to London when you were about 6 or
I was,
you were
I was,
4 or 5.
I was 4.
Right.
Okay. I was almost 4. So, when everyone's got a story of the first single they bought and it's always something cool. Mine was Roland Rat's Rat Rapping.
Oh, nice.
Great song.
That was, Fingers in the Fur, Let's Find That Flea, Chest of Nair, Right to the Knee. But fortunately for me, my brother and I when we were children, we had a friend who was like he was a very distant cousin and he was almost like a third sibling to us as we were growing up. And he lived on his own with his dad as a child. And we'd go to his house and this boy, his name was Marziar, and he was obsessed with the Beatles.
Wow.
Obsessed. So we were so little. I remember it was year, whatever year, people can work out. I hope the Russians love their children too. Do you remember that? Is it Sting? Yeah. How can I tell my little boy? If it was that year. So I think I can't have been more than 9, maybe 10. And Marzia had the Magical Mystery Tour album. And he had, I think he had all the Beatles albums. And he had taught himself the piano in order to be able to play Beatles songs.
Wow, and cool kid.
He was a very cool kid. and he... it was only when I was an adult I found out that he was having a massively tough time then as well. And it kind of goes to explain a lot of his quite obsessive immersion in music. But for me, he was my musical education, and the Beatles played heavily in that. And I don't think I realized when I was a kid that the Beatles were grown-up music. Because the way my childlike ears heard "I am the egg and the war is cuckoo," I thought it was like kids' songs. I had no idea that adults listened to this. So yeah, that's how I came to the Beatles and love them, because their songs told stories as well, which appealed to me as a child more than sort of the pop music that was in the charts at the time. Appealed to me. Like, I used to watch Top of the Pops and stuff, but it didn't hit home the way my friend Marzia's albums did. And I think it's probably the first time I used to sit and listen rather than have music on in the background was the Magical Mystery Tour.
What was there any particular songs on Magical Mystery Tour that leapt out to you as a child?
Well, when I was older, actually, and my mum hated the song, The Fool on the Hill. I played that obsessively as a teenager.
Right. Yeah.
Obsessively. And I have an uncle who I think this is the first time I've ever talked about him publicly. But I have an uncle who is very severely mentally ill. And he, when I was growing up, you know, we'd go and see him in secure, when I was growing up, teenager, in secure mental institutions. And if anyone listening has experience of being in one of those places or visiting someone in one of those places, they can attest that it's a tough one to take, right? And that song, The Fool on the Hill, always then started to make me think of my uncle, because he was the guy who would be sitting on a bus with a wig that he found in a skip, and there'd be kids throwing chips at his head. You know, he was that guy.
Yeah.
The guy that everyone walked past, pull their kids away from the weirdo. When I was at school, I think I was about 16, the cuss at my school in the 80s would be like, you live at St. Bernard's, because St. Bernard's was this old Victorian mental hospital in Ealing, right, where I live. And that was the way people would slag each other off. I changed that "we" because I never did, because I'm tremendously kind.
Yeah. You're morally perfect. Yes.
And an all-round delight. So
yes,
I remember everyone was crowding around the Ealing Gazette and laughing. And I was like, what are they laughing at? And someone said, oh, a loony's escaped from St. Bernard's and he's jumped on a car. And there was a picture of my uncle on the front page of the Gazette, and he was obsessed with Bruce Lee, in a Bruce Lee pose. And I looked at it and I just turned away, and I felt, I felt so sad, because, you know, none of them knew that guy. None of them knew that my uncle actually talks the most sense sometimes than anyone else I know, and he's really funny, and he was a brilliant, brilliant young man, and this illness manifested in his late teens, early 20s, as is quite common, I think, with his sort of thing. And so The Fool on the Hill to this day makes me cry, because it makes me think of just people we don't understand and people that we dismiss, and I've always been drawn to people like that. Well, on the way
in a cloud. The man of a thousand voices talking perfectly loud. But nobody ever hears him or the sound he appears to make. And he never seems to notice what the fool on the hill.
It's a song, even without a connection as strong as that, that does seem to key into this idea, obviously, of like the wise fool. And I always think it's not a coincidence that, you know, I Am the Walrus ends with a bit of King Lear and Fool on the Hill. You know, it makes, you know, I'm not saying it's an illusion, but there is, you know, there is obviously the fool in Lear who's the wisest character in the play and everything. And also, you know, and then people like Mr. Dick in David Copperfield, played brilliantly by Hugh Laurie, that kind of clear, that kind of innocence.
Yeah, quite a dignity of...
And obviously the great thing about Fool on the Hill as well is that he's not being heavy-handed about this in a kind of... It's not even clear if he is talking about what we might describe as someone with mental health problems. But, like, I think it works so well as a song because you can kind of... read that into it, I think.
Well, which I did, because obviously I heard the song long before my uncle came to live with us. And it's that, it's just, to me, it's a song about people who have no idea, no inkling to manipulate anyone or want anything off anyone. Whereas the rest of us, often in our lives, we build our hives and our webs of people we need, people we care about, and you know, there is we all kind of work our own game to an extent, and then here's somebody on a hill who's just being, and it's so easy to just walk past. And my mom hated it. Yeah, I've never known her to have such a visceral. She goes, "Oh, it's the eyes in his head, see the world spinning round." I think it just made her feel really. She found the song really disconcerting.
Well, it is eerie, isn't it? The recorders are eerie. You know,
recorders are usually a complete no-no for me. They're my least favourite musical sound. Bar none.
But it's creepy.
But they kind of work in that because there's something uncanny and folky about recorders. Yeah. But I think that song is sort of, it's McCartney at his absolute songwriting peak in Beatles.
Yeah.
So I love his sort of detached sort of character pieces. I always think of it as a bit of a companion piece to something like Eleanor Rigby, really, where it's like, how are you writing this stuff at 26, 27? I just find it absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah. I'll tell you how, because they didn't have ironing to do at that age.
lunches
to make.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say drugs.
Oh, well, yeah, maybe. It's funny how... the drugs didn't enter my head with that album because I came to it as a child, and naively, it wasn't until I was really old, like quite an experienced adult, before I got the jokes about tripping and stuff with regard to that album.
I mean, looking back on it, the clues are there.
But the great thing about Fool on the Hill, again, from like a child's perspective, you know, even before you like know anything about music, what's great about it from the McCartney songwriting thing that Jack's talking about is, you know, he's doing something weird when it goes to that minor thing. It's so unexpected.
Yeah.
And you don't really have a name for it. And then you know, you might work out later, oh, he went to the minor there. That was such an unusual choice. But you've always known there was something slightly unsettling about it, but you didn't know how to name it.
Well, I've just realised right now what that is. It goes to the minor.
Isn't it like C major to C minor? I don't know.
Yeah. I can't remember what key it's in. I just remember it's very sort of like alliterative in its sort of word painting of, I always, you know, you're following that melody up, literally up the hill until it sort of dies away. So it's quite like, it's quite on the nose in terms of its word painting. But absolutely love that. That song in the top 10 for me, I think. Top 10 Beatles tracks for me.
Brilliant. So, Shappy, I was going to ask then about, because you obviously mentioned your upbringing, you moved to the UK when you were very young. So in your book, A Beginner's Guide to Acting English, you write brilliantly about that kind of experience. You write brilliantly from the perspective of a child. And obviously being a young child, not knowing who Father Christmas is and being in this completely new culture, completely new language. So, I mean, this is kind of quite a broad question, I suppose, but was like discovering the Beatles, was that something like... Was it a bit like discovering who Father Christmas was? Was it like this kind of, was it like this new? Was it kind of an introduction to the West, for want of a better way of putting it, or was it not really that?
No, it wasn't. I think when you're a kid, I mean, the age I was when I came to England, I was at an age where if a dragon had come into my bedroom, a pink dragon offering me a plate of marshmallows to burn on its fire, I would have gone, oh, wow, mummy, come and look at this. So I didn't make the East-West connection as a kid because everything's new. But I feel, thank you for saying I was that book did well talking from a child's perspective, because I am very, very connected to my childhood. I'm not one of those people who sort of thinks of it as a part of their life and they remember a trip to Disneyland and a row with their mum. I'm frequently revisiting my childhood. It's my thing, and I get in touch with people from my childhood, and I, you know, like talking it to them, and they're always astounded by my memory.
Yeah,
I was in the Isle of Wight the other day, and I just in a restaurant, this man turned around to me, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I went, yes, he was my PE teacher at school.
Oh,
and I instantly, without missing a beat, told him a story that he told us when we were 12.
Wow.
So and I said, you know, I remember. And he went, wow, how do you remember that? And his kids were with him, his grown-up children. And they said, oh, he's always telling us that. He's told us that story before. So I do, and I think pretty much everything I've written, I've gone back to my childhood. So no, the Beatles weren't a connection to the West, because I still don't see them as I don't differentiate between music that I like and what, that there isn't a clear defining line between, you know, East and West for me. It's all a big mush. But what it was an introduction into losing yourself in music. And sometimes I feel I wish I'd discovered them a little later, maybe my teens, but I was very little. I was a kid, you know, climbing trees and all of that when I was listening to the Beatles. And also I got obsessed for a while with John Lennon. And I met this little girl who, and so at this point I'm about 30, right? And I meet this little girl, a friend's daughter, and this little girl is phenomenal. She's just really smart, really clever, and she's got her headphones on. We've gone to a restaurant, she put her headphones on because this is the days before phones, you know, games. So her way of zoning out of the adult's boring conversation was to listen to music, and she was listening to the Black Eyed Peas and various other things. And I had my Walkman with me, and I said, here, let me play you a song and see if you like it. And I played her John Lennon's Imagine, and she listened to it, and then she took the headphones off and she goes, yeah, I ain't a teenager yet.
That's incredible.
What a child. I ain't a teenager yet. And
that's so
what a great review of that song as well.
Brilliant. And I kind of sometimes I wish that, you know, if I'd come to them a bit later. It's like meeting like someone that you love dearly and want to spend the rest of your life with when you're 17. In a way, I think I would have got different things, and maybe they would have been my favorite band. But as it happened, it ended up being Depeche Mode, because that's when the lightning bolt struck when I was 15.
Well, Depeche Mode, I think they're I mean, at their best, Depeche Mode are always about, we're talking about McCartney, for me, always about those little quirks of melody or just slightly interesting chord change that really sticks out, you know. That, for me, is what makes them so amazing, I think.
And they do sort of, like, dovetail in and out of fashion in the same way that McCartney does as well. So, yeah, you know, you're always going to be on the money every few years with Depeche Mode, I always find.
That's such an interesting thing, though, about, like, I mean, I've vividly remember stuff trying to get into something that's, like, I don't know, say, like, Captain Beefheart or some prog or something when I was much too young and be like, no, oh, no, I need to be a teenager. Like, it's this is scary. I'm scared. why is this so long? I'm scared.
You know what's interesting with music is with my children, I'm quite careful of when I give them certain things to listen to. And then you never know what's going to hit them. Like, my daughter's only, she was only seven and we were going to ballet or somewhere. And on my playlist came Radiohead's Creep. She's very talkative like me. And she was utterly quiet. And then I looked at her and she had like this little tear down her face.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh my God, that's mad. That's just, and I didn't talk, you know, I just said, did you like that? And she just nodded and she didn't want to talk about it anymore. And I didn't make a thing of it. We just like went on with our day. I just let her have her, whatever it was, reaction she was going through, listening to a song. And I just thought, how incredible is that? Whereas that's something that I would probably have like not thought, oh yeah, when she's like older, she'd get into that. But
yeah,
there's something about certain songs. I think the Beatles played a huge part in me wanting to be a performer.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Massively. The Beatles and the Muppet Show were huge influences on my life. When I was at the last year of my primary school, we did a play, our end of year play. Now, we had a really creative staff at my school, Montpelier School in Ealing. And instead of like getting a play off the shelf and doing it like Bugsy Malone, the teachers wrote a play and they did it to the soundtrack of the Beatles.
Oh, right. Oh,
wow. Yeah, they did it to a Beatles soundtrack. So we did Help, I Need Somebody and like, you know, Man Again, Buy Me Love and all of that. And Your Mother Should, you know, all of that.
And so did the plot kind of revolve around the songs or were the songs just placed there?
They were placed strategically. So the play was about, so where
I mean, it sounds more consistent than the film Help, to be honest.
I think that was a big influence, but I think our play was better. Back in the 80s, there was a massive Bentalls stall in Ealing and it had shut down. So the play was about what to do with the site of Bentalls. And there was a group of people from the council that wanted to make it into a youth centre. And then there was an evil tobacco company that wanted to make it into a tobacco factory. And me and my best friend Chloe, we played Benson and Hedges.
Nice.
So, we were the evil ones. So the story was that, and then, you know, I get by with a little help from my friends, sang the council lot, the team, and they all grouped together. And then the evil ones sang all the songs about money and all of this. So that play was all about, all Beatles songs. And we all had to learn them. And that was our homework, to learn the Beatles songs off by heart. And for me, the songs were stories and they were theatrical and they had real character and they built characters for you in your mind, and that really appealed to whatever nonsense makes me want to be a performer. So
Well, I think that's one of the things. I mean, we sort of often come back to George Martin, but I'm talking about his kind of role as producing comedy records and things for the Beatles. But I think sometimes what makes the Beatles songs so good in many ways is the production, where they're almost done like a sketch, if that's somehow makes sense. Or that they're kind of, what I like about George Martin is he has that kind of attention to detail of which comedians need. You need to have the voices heard. You need to get the punchlines over, let's say. So he almost does produce music as if it's like a comedy sketch in a way. I mean, it's take an obvious example, like Yellow Submarine or something.
Yeah.
Where it does feel like there are voices coming and going, sound effects, you know.
It's a show. He puts on a show.
Yeah, it's a show, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a show.
Yeah.
And it's also that thing of, like, I don't know if you've ever, like, I record music at home and, you know, I try to, but like sometimes when you're doing something and you might just like do something as I work on this other podcast and I do some jingles and like you might put a little funny jingle together and you go, why is that better than any song I've ever written? You know, because it's like you're not thinking about the music. So sometimes I think George Martin's really good because he's almost like from that comedy perspective, he's kind of making something I can't explain
yeah.
it.
Yeah, I know. And then and you've got, they are a double act as well.
Yeah.
And a
yeah.
lot of the, you know, John and Paul work so well together. And
yes,
there's something yeah. very theatrical about their relationship and the way that
yes,
they're sort of
yeah.
antithetical but symbiotic. And
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to, what was the name of the play? It was.
I can't remember, but I think it might have been called Bentles.
Really?
Sounds like a copyright nightmare, but I would yeah. I'd love to see it.
It was the 80s.
But it sounds like they put more thought into it than like We Will Rock You, the Queen musical, where it's like, we need to cross the seven seas of rye. Like, you know, yeah. there's just springs. And, you know, it sounds like it's slightly more produced yeah. than that.
Well, it was amazing. And I never forgot it. The thing, Robin, that you were just talking about with double act and with the production and all of that, I think you're absolutely spot on. A lot of the time, people put comedians under the same umbrella as actors. Mm. And actually, we're very different animals to actors. Mm. I know some comics act too, and some actors do comedy. But I think in terms of our spirit, we're much closer to musicians and teachers.
Yeah.
I personally think that, and I know for myself, that comedians, if they could have, they'd much rather have been musicians. If I had had the skills to be a musician, that's the road I would take. And I think our fascination with musicians is that because comedians connect with their emotions as well, but they have to present it to you as something other than just emotion. They've got to present it to you as in a way that you'll come in on, like you make them see the world as you see it. Whereas musicians present their emotions in a much more way, in a much more, either you get it or you don't. They're not, I don't want to say the word needy, but I always think like musicians comedians are like, love me, love me, love me. But musicians are more like, kneel before Zod, you know? But ultimately, yeah. we want people to come our way.
Yes.
But yeah. do it in very different ways. And I am, whenever I, let's face it, date musicians, which tends to be a lot, that affinity is there because I find musicians have the keenest sense of humor.
Yeah.
They've got such a good, the ones I've met have, and they value a sense of humor. They value the communication that a sense of humor gives and the dimension that it takes you to. So I do think that musicians and comedians are kind of very, very curious of each other and very, adoring in some ways of one another. Or the musicians that I've been out with have adored me anyway.
So, I think they both have they seem to have that part, that missing part of each other's things that they fit together. I mean, John Lennon, we've like mentioned before, has always said towards the end of his life that he would much rather have been in Monty Python than the Beatles and stuff. And it's like, well, if he's still got that empty space that he's trying to fill.
It is. That's exactly what it is. And they look at us and they see the instant connection.
And it's also about that kind of balancing sincerity and humor, I think, which is one thing the Beatles do so well.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, just having watched Bo Burnham's Inside, The great
I can't
successor.
Wait to watch that. I can't
wait.
Oh,
you haven't
wait.
Seen it yet?
I haven't
oh, my
seen
God,
it.
It's amazing.
It's my little gift. It's my gift to myself when this crazy week that I'm having dies down.
Cool. Mm. Well, enjoy it. You know, I won't spoil it, but it's great.
It's not a laugh riot, but it's the great sort of... I think we all knew that there was a sort of lockdown masterpiece being created somewhere, and that the great piece of lockdown art would turn up. And actually, it wasn't that surprising that he did it because he's.
You mean it wasn't the American celebrity singing Imagine? That wasn't it.
Yeah, that was an early front runner, but it.
Raised my expectations sky high.
But the amazing thing about Inside is it is that balancing of sincerity and humour, isn't it? Because it's so funny, but then he can do something so incredibly serious. It's really quite beautiful. The songs are very beautiful, and then just go into little skits, and that's what. Gives it its heart is the balancing of that. I can't believe he does a song about moaning about being 30. It's like, oh God, what are you at 40,
mate?
He was
I saw him at the Edinburgh Festival when he was, I think he was still a teenager when he...
Yeah, he's like 17, 18.
You see, I'm fascinated by that. Like, I think that's what I find fascinating about musicians is the sincerity. Mm. Like my 17-year-old cousin is a musician and she will sit at the piano, any gathering, no shyness, nothing, and spelt out a song that she's written herself.
Wow.
About her heartache. And she'll have us all in tears and she'll finish it and she's like, you know, done. And it's amazing. Yeah. And I'm like, I can't do that. That's the thing that I think... You know, musical skill aside, I feel like if I don't like dress something up positively at the end of it, then I've wasted everyone's time.
Yeah,
it's or at just least that kind of funny sound effect to fall back on in case you don't do it properly. No, there was that Stuart Lee show I think that about 10 years ago that ended with him playing a guitar, and it was his, I think he says like the last taboo in comedy is to try and do something sincerely and well.
Yeah,
which is something that Bo Burnham and the people like Tim Minchin managed to straddle, but I think he'd be hyper talented to be able to pull it off.
And
with LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I think I was the last person in the world to see Nanette.
Mm. Yeah.
Hannah Gadsby.
Right, Nanette did that. And that's such a hard thing to do well. Mm. And then so, like with everything, like with comedy, when someone does it, then other people try it. Like when I started on the circuit, Eddie Izzard was the game-changing comic. Mm. And every new comic, probably including me at the time, spoke in that slightly Izzard inflection.
Yeah.
And likewise, you see a lot of, you know, comics now doing... sincerity, but it's
made a really good process. I think it might be I can't remember who it was, it might have been Glenn Moore made a really good, it was just a tweet saying really good comedy makes the audience awkward, but unfortunately so does really bad comedy. So it's like hard to, you know, but that's so true, isn't it? It's like, you know.
I know, and I know we're straying.
There are a lot of people doing the sincerity thing, like badly, let's say. There are lots of people. It's become a thing.
Well, you know what? I mean, you can edit this out because I'm probably being a bit mean, and I try not to be mean in public. But a young comic got in touch with me recently and said, I want to do comedy. Can you help me? And I was like, oh, fair play to your confidence. Yes. Okay. So here's some I did a comedy course that gives you confidence. Here's some comedy courses you can try. Here's some online stuff. Here's some gigs you can go to. Binge on comedy. That's the best advice I can give anyone. Just watch tons of comedy. And she wrote back to me. She's saying, thank you for recommendations. And my plan with comedy is to make people laugh, but also educate them around issues concerning, and she gave me a list of issues. And I was like, good luck, mate. Good luck. There's nothing I can do for you here. I gave you, I gave you what I had. I gave you, you could have, you know, I'm so willing to help people. But if before they've even got up and done their first gig, their idea is I want to educate people. It's like when other comics are, like you just did with Glenn Moore, when other people are quoting your jokes, then start thinking how I'm going to, you know, change the shape of the world.
It's quite a big, it's quite ambitious.
It's a bit like sort of trying to play jazz before you've learned the chords, really.
And you know what? You know, I just felt really sad because I love the fact that she had the confidence to write to someone and ask for them to be her mentor. You know, I never had that confidence. So never mind. Pat, it's not too late for me to have a mentor. I might try and find one.
Yeah, another album you mentioned in to Jack was this because of the school play, but you're a big fan of the Help album.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Help album. Again, you know, I'm somewhat, because I've now realised that my scatterbrainness is neurodivergent. I've not been like, I always felt, you know, you get the, I feel that I'm a real music geek. But I can't compartmentalise and remember albums and dates or whatever the way proper music geeks can. So I've always
neither can Paul McCartney, apparently.
So yes, I binged on the Help album. And again, these are all albums that I'd have to go to my friend Marzia's house to listen to. And I never had the money to buy my own. So when I went to university and I got my grant, the first thing I did was buy myself a CD player. And I bought the Help album, I bought Sgt. Pepper, I bought the Magical Mystery Tour, and I bought a heap of Simon and Garfunkel records.
Nice.
Lovely. Yeah, so, and then I got quite obsessed with John Lennon as a person. Yeah. Like, I think as a, I remember sort of being, like, reading everything I possibly could about him and listening to all of his solo stuff. And thinking that if I had ever met him, I would have run to hide. I think I would have been so intimidated by him. And looking back at, and even when I was growing up, sort of Yoko hate was common. You know, I remember as a comedy obsessive watching Dennis Leary, American comic Dennis Leary, do a show, and I had it on video, and I know it off by heart, and he said, we live in a world where John Lennon takes however many 16 bullets to the chest, Yoko Ono is standing next to him, not one fucking bullet, and the audience roars with laughter. And I was you know, I was a teenager, and I was like, oh, that's so funny, because we want her dead. And you know what, if that happened today, it would be a Meghan Markle situation. We would understand that she's an outsider.
Yeah.
You know, she's you know, she's not, she doesn't fit in for reasons more than her music.
And I like to think we have gone past that, but in some ways, sadly, we haven't. As many people who are critics of the Craig Brown book will attest that he's very harsh about Yoko, which is just, you know.
Absolutely.
Like someone said recently, you can't be a John fan without loving Yoko.
Absolutely. You know. And you know, the other thing is about her is, to this day, you know, when someone's got a girlfriend that a group of mates aren't all that into, they'll go, oh, she's Yoko. I had to be, and I know that I probably sounded like the most sanctimonious twat at the dinner party, but I was like, that's not fair. that's not fair, you know, whatever, you know, I am a bit of a sanctimonious.
It's kind of, I've never made that sort of connection between the Meghan Markle thing, but it's actually, it's a very, in terms of the tabloid representation, it's very, it's this sort of weird protectiveness over, or entitlement to think that John Lennon is like our thing, like, you know, Britain's great, you know, export, when actually he really couldn't give a shit about
you know what, to be kind and to be polite, I would call it xenophobia, but you know,
I think we can call it racism.
There we go. And to love, like exactly what you said, to love John Lennon and to dehumanize the woman that he was in love with. And I don't know what it is about, there's two people, fans and family, think that have more of a right to you than the person that you have met and chosen to be your family, you know? And, you know, I even listen to Yoko's stuff occasionally, you know, on a quiet night.
Yeah. Well, she's a fascinating artist.
She's brilliant. She's a fascinating artist. She's a brilliant character. She's still really full of verve and vibrant and positivity. And she put up with him. Imagine that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
She put up with him. She forgave him.
Yeah.
Everything. And that's that compassion is really important. And also, like, you know, and I know that people say stuff, you know, John Lennon was this and that. And I know that I'd be terrified of him if I met him. But, you know, I have huge compassion for John Lennon, whatever he was like in his life towards Yoko and all of that. Because no one is like the sum total of one part of them, you know, like, I don't know. I feel that we can so often look back and judge people without, you know, understanding the circumstances they were in and the head that they lived in. And it's not excusing, it's being compassionate. And being compassionate towards things that are unpalatable is also human. Oh, I should write a song about this. What was I saying? Yeah.
I think that's why everyone goes through a stage in their life, though, where they identify with John in a way that they maybe don't so much with Paul, is because he's more multifaceted and more kind of flawed, and to, you know, straddles that kind of sincerity and comedy thing that we're talking about earlier, whereas someone like Paul is just a bit more consistent in character.
And a bit more able to deal with his shit.
Yeah, exactly. And I always think the great miracle with Paul is that he's sort of remotely normal.
Yeah.
Whereas John was kind of heading that way, but you know, it's John. You just can't help but love him.
Yeah.
Even in the world where we're sort of recontextualizing characters like that.
Yeah. John was just so funny. You know, we're obviously talking about comedy a lot, but one of the things from recently rewatching Help is it's not like a great film, but like one of the best things about it is, you know, they did a lot of outdoor scenes and they had to dub over dub over their voices to narrate themselves climbing on a tank and stuff. And there, if the film was just those little bits, it would be brilliant.
Yeah.
Because John is fucking hysterical in those bits. There's the bit where they climb on the tank and you can just hear John go, "I hurt my suit." It's so good. But they were obviously like improvising and just mucking about. It's so funny.
It's so, so funny. And you know what? Who else enjoy looking at the life outside singing is Amy Winehouse.
Such
a brilliant sense of humour. Funniness just pouring out of her, and I find that the same with John Lennon. He was funny.
It's very true. Yeah, that like that bit in Amy where she's on holiday with a friend and she's showing around like a kind
that,
of
yes.
like she's the tour guide. It's just that is absolutely brilliant. She's just doing this character comedy and she's so funny. Yeah,
and she always knows where the camera is in a similar way to John as well. When you're on your 20th generic interview, I saw an interview, you might have seen it on Twitter the other day, where someone was asking her about basically trying to put words in her mouth about how her new record was really like Dido's last record.
Yes, that's great,
she's sort of looking sort of over her shoulder at the camera and just making these like really funny stupid yeah. faces that yeah. are really John Lennon-y, yeah. actually, the way that he used to do totally. His, like, yeah. I mean...
Prince did the same. Like, his eyes spoke far louder and funnier than his mouth when he's, like, faced with someone who's basically just being a bit... you know, a bit lame and trying to back them into a corner and trying to get yeah. them to, you know, so, yeah, exactly like you say, put words in their mouth. But yes, very funny yeah. man. Tell you something that is going to paint me in a very bad light and is probably massively indiscreet.
Yep.
But I had a boyfriend who was a musician and he was very lovely, but he didn't like the Beatles, which was kind of, I don't trust people who don't like the Simpsons.
Yeah.
And I also don't trust people who say I don't like the Beatles. Anyway, so I knew about this, and we'd go on long car journeys and we would listen to the Beatles albums, and he would get into a quiet little huff at certain songs, and then I'd be like, are you all right? And he goes, and look, Shappy, it's a bad song and this is why. And then he put on a tune he took over from other playlist, and he put on some song that was just really dreary. Yeah. I won't say the band because I don't want to slag off a band because other people love them, right? It was really dreary. And I said, I was trying to lighten the mood, and I said, can we listen to something that doesn't want to make me want to kill myself? And he said, the amount of shit I've had to listen to in this car. And all we played was the Beatles.
Wow.
And that relationship ended a week later.
Right.
Right.
Well, I just
these
couldn't.
Are important things.
It is an important thing for two reasons. Number one, how can you not like the Beatles? And secondly, if you're in the presence of people who love the Beatles, myself and my children, I think being rude about other people's music, fair enough. I told him his music made me want to kill myself, but I was joking.
Yeah.
I was joking. And I know that suicide's not something to giggle about, but I was kidding. And I thought, if you're going to get all po-faced about music that I like, because I once went out with somebody who looked at my music collection when I moved into his house, and I remember he said, that's never going to happen, and he put it all in a box, and all we listened to was Tom Waits for 5 years, which has its place, don't get me wrong, but I promised myself after that I would just not stay with somebody who didn't accept my music.
Have you noticed it's pretty much always blokes who have these real, like, kind of, like, it's this or that. You must like this. You cannot like that. You
and know, also pretty much blokes that I end up going out with. But, you know, it's interesting because another musician boyfriend of mine, we were talking about why it tends to be blokes that get so geeky about music. And I said to him, like, no, I think women get just as geeky.
Yeah.
But it's like comedy. There was a time where only blokes got geeky about comedy because it was seen as a blokey thing. But actually, I was very, very geeky about music. But there wasn't the gang to join, until I became a bit of a grebo in my later teens and got very, very into the Wonder stuff.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. But it's a strange one that people, I think, because the Beatles, it's quite rare to find people that don't like them. I mean, we've had John Robbins has been on, who's the only person who's been on this podcast who actively doesn't like the Beatles, but at least he can qualify it with the fact that he understands that the Beatles are amazing. It's just he finds it's not for him. But
it's funny because I feel exactly the same way as John Robbins. I feel about that way about him. I know he's not. I'm joking if he listens. You are my cup of tea, and I hope we have breakfast together in Sweden another time.
That's great. I thought you were going to just say Queen, but no, just straight.
Yeah, straight to John Frost.
Yeah, straight. But no.
But it's funny that people feel. Yeah, I don't really buy people who have that visceral reaction against the Beatles. Like you're trying to be cool by saying you actively hate them. Like, it's quite hard to hate.
How did you feel about talking to someone who actively didn't like the Beatles?
It's not that he actively. I'd say the problem with John is that he didn't really. The thing with John was he was so hung up on the fact that, let's say, a lot of the early stuff, in terms of, it's thematically quite one note, because they're all love songs.
Yeah.
Let's say, up until the Rubber Soul, maybe. You know, they're pretty much all love songs. But it's like having a go at Beethoven, because he wasn't using a wah-wah pedal, you know. It's like but it's like literally like,
yeah, if Beethoven had invented the wah-wah pedal, yeah, as well, later
they
on.
You have to go through that progress culturally to get to your Revolvers and Sergeant Peppers, and the Beatles built that progress. So
yes,
that's the kind of discussion we had, but it was after quite a lot of cans, so it didn't come off.
Yeah, do you know what, I'm getting a bit slurry. When I was when I was younger, so much younger than today, I remember discovering the Beatles, getting into the Beatles, and going, oh my god, my parents are the Beatles generation. And I'd be like, mummy, so in Iran, did Beatlemania happen in Iran? And my mum said, well, we wore miniskirts. that was it. And I remember just being slightly disappointed about having parents of Beatles generation, the way my son can say to me, like, yeah, oh my god, you've seen Michael Jackson, oh my god, you've seen Prince live, and I can say, yes, my son, they are my era. I always felt a bit cheated that I didn't have that. Oh, sorry, that I didn't have that with my parents. Like, my dad would go, oh yes, the Beatles, wonderful band, were you into them? And he goes, well, I was a journalist, I worked late.
From reading your book,
busy having a revolution, you know.
Your dad sounds like a fascinating character, and like, and you obviously grew up in a very like arty world, I imagine.
Very much so.
But the Beatles weren't a touchstone though at all, even.
I think that there was a language barrier. Having said that, I remember I went on a holiday to Paris when I was 15, and that's when I discovered Depeche Mode. And I met all these Parisian teenagers, and I hung out with them. And I then translated into French the Depeche Mode lyrics, and realized, oh my god, you don't care about the lyrics. That's insane. Like, how can you not care about the lyrics of the song? But people, you know, people do, you know. And and I think there was all that with the Beatles. And I don't think either of my parents, my dad was so consumed with being a writer and being a poet and all of that. And the revolution happened, and they just didn't have youth the way we had it here. Like teenage years here are a thing. But back then in Iran, particularly their generation, teenagers didn't have this like period of freedom and liberation to go and navel gaze and lose themselves to music and hedonism the way, because they would literally starve. They had to get jobs and get on with stuff. We're not kidding. This is a developing country, or third world country, as they were known back then. But I remember my dad always telling me when he heard John Lennon was shot, because it's, you know, having a, for a million reasons, being a poet and also being a journalist. And when John Lennon was shot, you know, him weeping, it was a huge, huge thing that I recall, and he's talked about. Because, you know, you don't often see your dad cry.
So what, if he wasn't a sort of, what was the connection there? Just that it was just an incredibly sad event, or was it
just understanding the value of this man?
Yeah.
Understanding the value, the intelligence, the artistic merits of this person that was a huge part our culture. And, you know, murdered in such a brutal way, especially coming from Iran, where, you know, it's, you know, being a dissident and being shot for your, you know, being shot for who you are or your opinions or whatever. And I know that wasn't quite the case. That wasn't the case with John Lennon, but there was a lot of death, you know, in my parents' life around then. And the West was always seen as safety. You know, the West was refuge. That's where people don't kill each other. That's where people and for that to happen on such a massive scale was really really huge, particularly for a lyricist, for an artist, for because that's the connection my dad has. Likewise, when the Charlie Hebdo atrocity, my dad was like, because my dad's a satirist, and he's like, they kill the journalists, they kill the right, they kill the comics, they kill the writers, and that they you know, they kill them because they're the ones with influence. They're the ones that talk to the every person, the layman. You know, they talk to the people who might not have the best education, that aren't, you know, that don't have privilege. But they talk to those people, and they're important, whether they're John Lennon or whether they're cartoonists on Charlie Hebdo. These are people who connect with ordinary people, you know, who are going by and large through their lives, causing no harm to anyone, but having to navigate massive obstacles themselves. And these are the people that connect with them, that give them hope, give them a voice in a lot of ways, and bang, gone. It's the saddest thing in the world.
I
think another great thing from the book, your book, is that you really get a sense of the Iranian sense of humor. Which seems like, obviously your dad is a satirist, and it seems like it's quite a dry sense of humor, and in many ways it seems like quite British sense of humor,
quite Celtic, I think. Beatles sort of sense of humor is very much a Celtic thing, isn't it?
You know, it's really so interesting that you said Celtic. When I went to Ireland for the first time as a 24-year-old comic, and I was in Galway. And I was in this pub in Galway, and everyone was just so welcoming because I was a guest, and everyone was singing and in this pub and having a great laugh. And the party wasn't people scattered around a room. It was everyone together. You know, like you go to your average sort of house party in London, you go into someone's house, you're lucky if someone comes up to you and says, hello, I'm so-and-so, other than the house. You just have to go, straight to the kitchen. Whereas there, it's an event. This person's arrived, and you sit, and it's a communal activity having a party. It's not groups quietly together. And I was like, oh my God, they're Iranian. Like, this is what this is what Iranians are like. And I couldn't believe that my Irish friends had never made more of a thing about how different it was living in England. And so that was a huge, huge thing, and sense of humour. And let me tell you something about the English sense of humour. When we moved to England, my dad fell in love with England, because he said, because for all that I've just said, Iranians do have a veneer of formality that that sort of kicks ass on English formality, you know. We have like the, it's similar to French, where we have the tu and vous form, you know, the polite and informal, and even in our language there's a polite way of speaking, familiar way of speaking. You dress everything up so flowery when you meet a new person. It's like, no, please be my guest. No, I will die for you, sir. Oh, no, I will give my liver rather than you be standing up. Please take my chair. I'm sorry, I have my back to you, but a flower has no front or back. All of this stuff, right? But my dad said, English people, they joke with you from the start. Like, you'll meet an English person in a lift in an office block, and you're in the same lift, and they will crack a joke with you. And he always made me see the beauty of that part of the British culture, in that cracking a joke with a stranger is as ordinary as saying hello. It's a way to connect, and that's why I don't like the term dad joke, because it's derogatory. I think a dad joke is somebody taking a risk at a barbecue. I could not talk to you, or I could say I've got one son, as long as I know. So what do they say? One son is as far as I know, and everyone goes, that person's taken a gamble. And what he said what someone says when they're doing that is, I want to be friends. Do you want to be friends? Then let's be friends. That's what it is. That's something that I don't think British people appreciate about themselves. And I say this as someone who has the privilege of being an insider and an outsider. So enjoy that beautiful thing.
And I think that's a lot of the reason why the world sort of fell in love with the Beatles, isn't it? Those early press conferences where there's probably not one straight answer until about 1966. People quite like that.
You know, at the very beginning of this podcast, you asked me if I saw the Beatles as like a symbol of the West. And I don't know if you noticed, but I got slightly defensive when I answered.
Yes, I saw. Well, no, I didn't think you got... I just thought I'd asked a stupid question.
But I did kind of go, no. But actually, now that we are friends, I will tell you that when I was little and we moved to England, and when it came to staying, when it became clear that we had to become refugees, we had a choice between staying in England, going to Paris, or going to Los Angeles. And we stayed in, my parents decided that London would be our refuge. How privileged were we to even have a choice where to be refugees? And a massive reason for that was my father regarded Britain as the hub of art, the hub of artistic culture. And the Beatles were a huge part of that, that reason for thinking that Britain was the best place to be. And when I was growing up, and I have this real patriotism towards England that is very different to other kind of patriotism that is the wrong kind of I'm joking, nothing's wrong kind of patriotism. But the fact that the Beatles were English or British, I thought that was just something we had over America. I just thought, suck it up, bitches, we got the Beatles. And that really competitive spirit of mine.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Was very vibrant when I was little, because you know they had Grease, they had the cool accents, they had cheerleaders and all of that. But you know, I raise you the Beatles.
It's a trump card, isn't it?
That was a huge thing, because for me, not being born in England, I had to find my own bits of it to root me here. And so Enid Blyton was one, you know, and the Beatles was another one. David Bowie was as well. Pantomime was, and old school music hall songs, you know, the old wall songs, like you know, my old man said follow the van and all of that. I know so many music hall songs you will not even believe. So all of those things were my way of, like any kid that's adopted, I found my way of feeling that I belong and that you know, music, and particularly the Beatles and other bands that this is not a podcast about, were massive.
That's great. That's so beautifully put. That's brilliant.
That was the fantastic Shappy Corsandi. I absolutely loved that. We don't have favourites, but that's one of my favourites.
It was a great chat. I did feel like I was just down the pub having a, you know, good old chinwag with someone. It was great.
I mean, she's just so unbelievably nice and a joy to talk to. A real pleasure. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with a fantastic episode with Beatles superfan / encyclopedia Mr. Jeff Lloyd.
Now this was one where I was pretty nervous before, because you want to do your homework, don't you, with Jeff Lloyd?
Yeah, but I mean, he's fantastic, lovely bloke. Yeah. And he was really brilliant, but he knows his shit.
He
in a
really
way that,
knows his stuff.
We really don't in some areas.
But it was just great. I mean, he's very open. He's very nice about this podcast as well, and he's very
lovely bloke.
He's really kind of just open to talking, because he just loves talking about the Beatles. So it was just great to just.
There's a great bit in his podcast which is called Beetlejuice.
Yeah,
if you haven't heard it, where I was catching up with it the other day, and he talks about how he bought the in Tune In, it goes into some detail about where the Beatles bought all their famous Beatle boots from. And if you want to know how much of a fan Jeff Lloyd is, he tracked down this shop and bought himself some Beatles boots that he got married in.
Oh, nice. That's great.
It's just superb. But check that out. He does it with his wife, Sarah Barron, who's also brilliant.
Yeah, she's a fantastic comedian, Sarah Barron.
So all of that coming up next week. As always, an extended version of that on the Patreon, which you can sign up to now. It's patreon.com/personalbeatles. And we'll see you next Tuesday. Cheers,
bye.
Robin.
Bye. Bye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.